Hey friends, this is Boss Barista. I'm Ashley Rodriguez.
My name is Ildi Revy, and I'm the Director of Learning for Ally Coffee, which is a green coffee importer. And I'm also the Director of Coffee for Purity Coffee, which is a coffee and health project.
The Director of Learning kind of sounds like my dream job. Can you talk a little bit about what that is?
Well, in the past, we've talked about education and training, and learning incorporates all of that. Learning also, I feel, is collaborative, which is what we do a lot in the coffee industry. We learn from each other. I think anybody who is a trainer or an educator in coffee has said at one time or another that they learn more from teaching than they feel they've taught in some cases. I mean, sometimes we're doing repetitive training on an espresso machine or brewing devices. But at the same time, as you watch the people that you're working with, every single person thinks differently and operates differently. So when we have to come and help them to master a skill or acquire some knowledge and they're approaching it differently, we have to figure out new ways to do that, which is our learning. So directing learning has to do with helping companies achieve what they envision is their reason for existing, and that's through learning. A lot of organizations are learning. And it also has to do with the employees of the company learning what they need to do to, you know, be on board with the company's vision and help the company to where they're going. So that's what the Director of Learning means to me.
You also do a lot of work at Ally with helping people get hired and figuring out job descriptions too. Isn't that right?
Well, yes, at Ally, I have both an external function, which is the events that we give, but also internal Ally. So each one of the employees at Ally, and we're starting a new talent development initiative at Ally, and that is to help really focus each one of the jobs at the company, at the importing company. I mean, we have logistics people, we have sales people, we have buyers, we have upper management, and everybody has learning to do, and they also have tasks that they have to complete that all, you know, are part of the great puzzle piece, the puzzle that is the organization. So, yeah, so I help with the job descriptions, which has to do with looking at the what some of the outcome. It starts with the outcomes. Why is this job needed here? And what are the tasks that people have to complete in this job? And what do they need to know and be able to do to complete those tasks proficiently? And then is there anything else that the job requires, which is what we call the affect, or, you know, the attitude or some other A. So any job and any job task can be broken down into knowledge, skills, and affect. And by analyzing that and getting that on paper in a job description, it helps an employee or staff member think through what they need to do to achieve their goals. And then if something isn't right, then they have a discussion with their manager or supervisor. Maybe.
It's really interesting that you guys do a lot of work to ensure that people are successful, it seems.
Well, yeah, because a lot of businesses count on Ally to help them, you know, do what they need to do. We've got to get coffee to roasters who have customers who are waiting for them. So we feel really strongly we have to be very competent at getting that done, because if we skip a beat and a coffee roaster's shipment arrives 2 days late, I mean, it's really, it you know, it's exponential. So so we take very seriously how we master each one of our jobs. So that's what I'm trying to do now, is to restructure this and look at it systematically and systemically.
I first met you at a barista camp in 2012, and you were teaching a group of people who were learning how to be like leaders or instructors. And something that I was really blown away by, because I learned this when I was a teacher, is that you always want people to be successful. So you should really like give them all the tools to do so. Like, a test is not a test to see if someone will fail. A test is a test to see if you taught them well. And that kind of completely revolutionized the way that I thought about like being a leader.
Well, I come from a background. One of my credentials is, we talk about certification in our industry, but there's actually a real definition to what a certification is. And anyway, we'll go into that later if you want. But I'm a certified performance technologist, a CPT, which means that I use the human performance technology model that was created by behavioral theorists, started in the 1950s. And it looks at the work that people do in as part of a system. The main thing is that we leave school, our school system that we are dealing with. And I have a kid in high school and a kid in college. And it's very interesting watching them transition through the American school system. And the way we all have learned, in if we've gone to one of these traditional public schools, is very different than when we get to the workplace, because the outcomes have different meaning and different, weight to it. And so workplace learning should never be delivered the same way high school or college learning was delivered, or even training. I mean, we're not really sports training either. It's a whole other thing. Although I do feel like professional sports is sometimes a much better metaphor for how we should operate than the school system. So the way the human performance technology model is created is, it starts with an analysis of the organization and an analysis of the environment in which the organization is functioning. And then we study what is the performance we need from the people in the organization, and really clearly define what are the expectations for completing this job to the level that we need for the outcomes we need at the company. And then we look at, well, let's look at each individual person. Are they meeting the expectations? Often people exceed them. Sometimes people exceed them or meet them, some of the expectations, but others they need work on. So what we have to do is define what is not happening. What are they, and very specifically, and that's what they call the gap. I mean, it's a gap analysis. We do gap analysis in many fields, but in human performance technology, it's the difference between what is desired workplace performance versus actual workplace performance. And then once we've defined the gap, we try and figure out what is causing this. And it could be so many things. Very often, when people are not performing, upper management just turns to a supervisor and says, fix those people. And they just throw training programs as a solution, when we need to step back and say, well, hang on a sec. What is the causing this gap in performance? Is it a lack of environmental support? Is it data, information, feedback? Is it resources? Is it tools? Are there consequences or incentives or rewards, you know, for the performing or not performing? Is it skills and knowledge? If it is, then it's an issue that we can throw training and education at? Or is it an individual's capacity? Like, for example, I just do not have the capacity to dismantle a drum of a roaster, pull it out, change the back bearing on the coffee roaster, grease it, and put the machine back and align it properly. I can't do that. I physically don't have the capacity to do that. There are a lot of people in our industry who do. So if that's some task that I'm not doing, like maintaining the roaster, we need to find a solution. So either I'm the wrong person for the job, or we need to change the job, my job description. And then, so there's individual capacity within the person, but then each person comes to work with their own motivations and expectations and habits and attitudes. And that is what lies within the individual. So I come to a job with my capacity, but I also come with my skills, habits, attitudes, behaviors, and things like that. And all of that impacts the job, but that's not the only thing that impacts the job. So we have a lot of things that we want to analyze as a cause of not performing a skill. And then once we figure out what it is through the cause, then we can find the solution. Is it instructional support, or is it non-instructional? Is it posters we put up around the workplace that just explain things? Is it the actual work design? Is my day-to-day time, the way I spend my time during the day, designed properly for the system? Is it an organizational thing? Is it a communication thing? Is it a difference in understanding of what proficiency is? Is it something financial? Is it work tools? Is it ergonomic? You know, we can, you know, choose any of these solutions.
So it seems like you have to take a pretty holistic approach to a workplace before you can really assess where the gap comes from.
Yes. And that's the difference between workplace learning and school learning. And that's why I try to avoid education and training unless that's exactly what I mean as one of these interventions for performance. And too often I see companies, you know, we model what the behaviors that we've seen. So somebody is doing great as a barista or a roaster, and so then they're transferred to become the trainer, and they don't have any training or, you know, background as a performance improvement person. So they just revert to what they learned, which was at school. So we're going to have read a bunch of stuff and then do a bunch of stuff and do some tests. And yeah, and then it's not the solution that the workplace needs, because, you know, there's a whole lot of other stuff that is part of an organization. You're applying a high school or college or grade school solution to an organization, a company that has a different purpose than the school system.
How did you get to this point in your career? How did you get started in coffee?
In coffee.
I know that's going back, right?
Yeah, right. So it's funny because my degree is in history. And when I went to University of Texas, Austin, and I graduated with a degree in history, and I fell in love with history of the developing world. And I really looked at Africa and Latin America specifically. But Africa really spoke to me. And funny enough, one of my jobs when I was in college was to work for a former CIA officer named John Stockwell, who was actually spearheaded the war in Angola. He's basically back in the 60s, 70s. And So he was the highest ranking at the time I was working for him, was the highest ranking CIA officer to step out of the agency and actually expose some of the things that the CIA was doing. And anyway, I fell in love. He told me loads of stories about himself in Africa and Vietnam. And yeah, I was intrigued by it. So when I graduated, I tried to find a job. Here I had a history degree and had worked for this. He was a speaker and a writer. So I was like proofreading his manuscripts and helping answer his phone calls and set up speaking engagements for him and stuff. So I'm like, what do I do? So a friend of mine had just started working in Zimbabwe with a program that was, it was not the Peace Corps. The Peace Corps wasn't operating in Zimbabwe because at the time it was just after their civil war had ended. And historically in Zimbabwe, the education of Africans, the best education happened at the mission schools. So a lot of the leadership of the country, when the Ian Smith's government was ousted and an African, true African government was put in its place, they were educated from mission school. So they went to the headmistress of some of these schools, who was a Catholic nun, and they said, hey, help us create the same education for the rural people as the mission school people had. So they started an organization called Katarusi, where half of the teachers, the teachers would all live together on a mission, and half of the teachers would drive daily out to the rural schools, and so that the rural school children were getting the same education as the mission kids. So I worked for that organization, but we didn't really have a mission. I didn't live on a mission because it was a it was a group of priests and nuns from Toledo, Ohio, and they just had a house in a medium density compound in the Zambezi Valley. So every day, my British roommate, Andrea, and I, we would drive out to this school and teach. And I was teaching math and science. Here, I had a history degree. And they said, oh, you're our new math and science teacher. I said, you do not want me teaching your children math. But they said, oh, no, you can do that. So I would. We didn't have electricity. So I was like sitting up at night trying to learn the math that I had to teach the next day, making sure I was going to teach it properly. So I did that for 2 years. I came back to the States, and they say once you drink the water of the Zambezi, you can never leave. And not a day went by that I didn't miss Zimbabwe. But I decided if I were to go back, I wanted to go back in a capacity that was really going to help. And so I got, I looked into adult learning. And I started working on my Master of Adult Education with a focus on the workplace because it was just very interesting to me. And so while I was working on my master's, I also worked for a consultant who was one of the first diversity consultants. She was one of the basically founders of the field of diversity training, as it was called back then. And so I worked with her in that. I found that very fascinating. And I worked once on a job for the Cook County Department of Corrections, helping ex-offenders reintegrate into the job market. And then when I graduated, I got a job with a social service agency. And it was in the inner city of Chicago, on the north side, and started a learning program from scratch there for the residents. And after a while, it was an adult learning program. The all these high school students started showing up. And I would say to them, you guys can't be in here. You know, the public schools, I can't have you here. And they said, well, we learn more here than we do in the schools. So the Chicago Public Schools happened to open up a grant for alternative high schools. So we decided to start a high school. So I started this alternative high school in Chicago, and hired, qualified teachers, because I wasn't a qualified high school teacher, but we started a high school, and I sent one of my, a group of my teachers to a workshop, and one of them came back and said to me, you know, Ildi, they had a State Department, U.S. State Department is looking for somebody to help in Mozambique. And I said, oh God, I'm doing all this here, but you know, I still missed Africa. And I thought, well, let me just throw in my CV. You know, social service work is, I wasn't trained for that. So I wasn't looking after myself well enough and I was getting burnt out. So I thought this might be a nice thing to take a couple years off and then come back. And so I got the job in Mozambique and it was, through the United States Information Service. So I was, and my task was to train Mozambican English teachers to go into workplaces and design workplace specific language programs, because Mozambique is a Portuguese speaking country surrounded by English speaking countries. And after their civil war, they needed to increase trade between themselves and the other countries to help rebuild their country. So speaking English was critical. So we went into the port, the electric company, the sugar mill, the flour mill, you know, they were big peristatal type organizations. And we would analyze the workplace and the work and develop these programs. And then the U.S. started supporting the Catholic University there that was just being founded. And so I helped to create... It was funny because it was in the late 90s or the mid 90s, the computer, you know, business computer stuff. I know I was teaching. So I basically taught Excel and Word in Portuguese, Windows and Excel. It was funny. Anyway, so I did that. But the whole time I was there, I would go up to the mountains of Zimbabwe. I had years ago, I had met a writer named Doris Lessing. She was traveling in Zimbabwe, and the head of our organization, she stayed at our house. And so Doris and I, for about 5 days with Sister Dominica, drove around the country while she was researching her book called African Laughter. And I'm actually in her book.
I didn't know that.
As a young teacher from Chicago. I don't remember what page, somewhere in the middle of the book. Anyway, so Doris's son was a coffee farmer. So I had met him years ago, but unfortunately he passed away while I was doing my master's. And I always wanted to pay my respects. So I went up to do that. And I went to the old club that he used to hang out at, which was just above his farm. And I met a young guy there who was his neighbor, named Robert. And Rob and I hit it off and fell in love. And he's a coffee farmer. And so I married him. So that's how I got into coffee, in short.
Well, you needed all of those things to kind of happen exactly as they did, huh?
I know. It's funny. When you look at the chain of where, you know, each link of the chain. Well, the best thing is, Rob is actually one of the best coffee farmers I know. His coffee is beautiful, and he is so conscientious and loves the environment and does, you know, all this integrated pest management. And, you know, they retain hundreds of acres of natural habitat because there's some species that are really only found in that area of Zimbabwe. Like there are these monkeys called Simango monkeys, and they're really only found in two places on Earth. And one is on the farm. And one is, the other part is in the Drakensberg. So he feels very strongly to, you know, maintain this environment. But in addition, he's just a great farmer. So I learned a lot about coffee farming through him. And then some political issues happened. We'll just leave it at that. But there's a whole lot on land redistribution. And but it was accompanied by violence. And after my first child, she was just 2 weeks old, was born, suddenly all this violence erupted in Zimbabwe, and some of it got really bad. But we were in this very far, remote corner up in the mountains. And so it was pretty far away from us until about year four of the farm takeovers, when it started hitting our area. And at that point, we just thought, you know what, maybe we need to make a plan just in case. And at that point, I had my second child, two daughters. And there was actually a lot of violence against women happening too. And so we just thought, you know, let's get out of there. And then, now his parents were still on the farm, and the farm supported 1,000 people. We have a school on the farm and, you know, a lot of workers and their families. And, you know, Rob feels very strongly about, you know, responsible for all the people whose livelihoods depend on the farm. So he never, ever intended to leave the farm until he was forced off. So his parents were there and the workers were there. And so we came over and we decided we better bring over some coffee, because if for some reason the farm was taken over, if we had a container of coffee, we could do something with it. It's a commodity, right? We can sell it. And that would, you know, start our lives in America. So I came to America. The girls were 1.5 and 4.5. And, you know, we came to South Carolina because I looked on the internet and it looked like there was not a big coffee culture here. So we thought, okay, well, this is, you know, we would be a little bit of a bigger fish because there isn't much around here. Well, so it seemed on the internet. So we went to South Carolina, and I didn't know anything about roasting, but we thought, okay, well, let's just bring the coffee in. So we parked a container of coffee. Actually, it was offloaded by the high school football team. I donated to the high school football team, and they offloaded our first container of coffee. And we drove to Tennessee. At the time, Probot was there, and we pushed a roaster onto the back of our truck and drove it back to Greenville, well, to Traveler's Rest, and offloaded the roaster. And then we just started roasting coffee, and I learned to roast coffee like that way by doing one training session at Probot before I left with the roaster on the back of the truck. And so Rob dropped me off there, then he had to hightail it back to the farm. And so there I was with a container of coffee and a roaster and trying to figure it all out. And I had one employee. And before Rob left, he said, whatever you do, please do not open a cafe. We're not here to do that. We're here to do wholesale. But there we were on Main Street. So I dropped him at the airport. I got back and my one employee looked at me and she said, in the time that you went to the airport, 12 people came in here looking for a latte. And I looked at her. I said, well, we're going to have to figure out how to open a cafe. So I looked into it, and it was just good. I didn't have the money to do it. We'd sunk everything into, you know, moving there, bringing the coffee over. And the more people came in, I would look at them and I would say, you know what? I just don't have money for an espresso machine, or I don't have money for the pipes or the 3-basin sink or the hand sinks that are required by the health department. So this guy who worked for the Winn-Dixie was closing, and they had a whole bunch of stainless steel stuff in their back rooms that they just were giving away. So he loaded up the truck and offloaded a bunch of stainless steel tables and sinks into the place. And this woman said, oh, my mother, I put her into a old folks home. And so, you know, she's got this big deep freeze and another refrigerator. Do you need that? They're totally new. So I'm like, yeah, great. And then tables and chairs, people just brought tables and chairs in for us, and couches. And, you know, we had a brewer. And at that point I said, well, now we need an espresso machine. And somebody said, you know, there's this guy up in the mountains, and he has an espresso machine, and this love of his life went to Thailand, and he wants to go ask her to marry him. So he just needs money for a plane ticket. So I said, well, how much is a plane ticket? He said, $1,500. So I said, okay, I'll buy his machine for $1,500. So I did that. He got on the plane. Apparently he went over there and surprised her at this coffee shop in Bangkok, and she didn't know he was coming, and he got on his knee and she burst into tears. So I used to call that my love espresso machine. So we learned.
You basically like crowdsourced a coffee shop before crowdsourcing was a thing.
Well, yeah. I mean, the community built it for me and it just took off. And then I realized Rob was coming back in May. I dropped him at the airport in January. He went back to the farm. And I thought, oh God, how am I going to tell him I opened a coffee shop? So I waited and waited until he got off the airplane. And I said, you know, I've changed things around just a little bit. And the roasting company said, well, you just wait till you see it. And he walked in and slew of profanities. I asked you not to do this. But then he loved getting his lattes and his sandwiches. And, you know, so it actually turned out to be a great thing. But yeah, so that's how I got into the business. But that was 2005. I looked to the SCAA to help me to learn. And they had amazing coffee people who were volunteering to teach courses. So these were coffee people, but they weren't necessarily teachers or educators, learning professionals, whatever. And so I thought, if I volunteer, I can learn from these people, but then design the learning programs for them. I can write lesson plans and do PowerPoints and, you know, give them all the materials and help them think through how to deliver and prep and all this. So I volunteered, and in 2007, I joined the training committee, and it was great because I was like, okay, what do I need to learn first? So I went to the roasters first. So I start to, you know, help design the roasting classes. And then from there, the roasters at the time thought they were doing what they thought was called the certification program. So, you know, we were working on that, trying to do a true certification program, which then it's a much more complex thing, because basically a certification program, you need standards. And our industry to this day doesn't really have a lot of standards. I mean, what is a standard? If you think about roasting or barista for any length of time, how can you define what a standard is? What is the standard espresso? I mean, that's a question that's been debated for hours and hours by thousands of people. So, so we created, you know, a lot of classes, and from there we just decided we can't do certification because we don't really have enough standards, but we can have educational standards, learning standards. What are the basic things people need to learn for each of these jobs? And from that, we created the SCA certificate programs, which were the barista level 1 and 2, the roaster level 1 and 2, and the coffee buyer. So after, by 2011, I was doing way too much volunteering, and the SCA said, just come and work for us. So I started working for them in 2011. And help build these programs. And then I turned my roasting operation over to my roaster, who started working for me when he was 19 and part-time working in college. He graduated university, and I just wrote over 25% of the business to him. I'm like, here, you've earned this. Just, it's yours to run. And I just slowly worked my way out of the business till he bought it from me in 2015, paid off my loan, and that was it. And so I continued to work for the SCAA until things came to, we actually at the SCAA at the time, the Europeans came to us in 2012 and said, can you help us? So we gave them access to all of our Dropbox, and we went and did the teacher learning program that we had been doing for everybody else over there. And then they started forming their program, and they went in a different direction business wise than we did. So when the two organizations were about to merge, I felt like for myself personally, there were a few things. My kids, I really wanted it. You know, I'd spent much of their childhood working And of course, I was working on my own business. And so I had access to my kids, but I really wanted more time with them. And I felt like I had gone as far as I could go for myself professionally where I was. And I wanted to do something different. And at the time that the organizations were merging, plus, you know, they were going to combine the programs. And honestly, I didn't have the energy to try and figure that whole thing out. And there were better people, younger people, people with different ideas involved. So I thought, I don't need to be pushing my agenda. Because I have a very grassroots way of approaching education. Even though it's workplace learning, I feel very strongly that the community, people should learn in community and follow the industry and follow our customers and follow our producers. And so I like to involve everybody in that. So I left the SCAA and to work for Purity Coffee, which is a coffee and health project, which is very exciting to me, and I'm really passionate about that now. And what's great about that company is they are not coffee people; they're business people, and they're people from the technology sector, and they think about running businesses very different than we think about running businesses in specialty coffee. Like almost every time the CEO, he'll give me an idea about something, I'll be like, well, that's not the way it's done in coffee. And he's like, yeah, but let's try it this way. And we'll go that direction. And it worked. And I'm like, wow, why don't coffee people do it this way? So anyway, it's really interesting to work for a coffee company that are run by non-coffee. And so I did that. And at the same time, Ally Coffee, the importer, one of my best friends in coffee, Ricardo Pereira, he's just an incredible coffee professional. I mean, I feel like Ricardo has changed the way we look at Brazilian coffee almost single-handedly. The way he started coffee and just put himself out there. And he's just really, I can't say enough good things about him. Well, they were looking to expand their education program. And so he said, look, why don't you come on board and let's see what we can do together. So I started working full-time for Ally, and then I was working part-time for Purity, and that's where I am now.
What is exciting to you about your job? Like, where do you find the fulfilling moments? Because I think that's something that you probably think about for a lot of other people, but I wonder, like, what excites you?
I love the work that Ally is doing in terms of the production chain. And I'm studying, they have a really innovative way of looking at the producer to roaster whole chain. And it's different than I've seen other importers look at the chain. And so how can we be successful in moving? Our new motto is moving coffee forward. How can we really not only move the physical product, but help the industry move forward? So looking at the chains and looking at the people and what they do in the chain of coffee is so exciting to me, because we can change things. I think we can really improve our industry in a lot of ways. So I'm just really excited about the possibilities by working for this young company with young leadership that thinks differently and puts its people first, starting with the producers.
I think most of our listeners are probably either baristas or cafe managers, or maybe a lead barista, maybe a small company or mid-sized company, maybe looking to move forward or advance their careers or even just learn more about themselves to figure out what the next step is, what would you say to baristas who are still like trying to figure out like their pathways like in the coffee industry? Like how do baristas find their next dream job?
Oh, Ashley, that's such a big question because every person, is different. So baristas, I'll tell you one thing I know, a couple things I know about baristas. Number one is that they're some of the best tasters that we have in the industry. Hands down, whenever I was giving SCA classes, we would do cupping classes and the people who aligned the best with Q graders and who could really pull things out and elicit, explain what they were tasting in legitimate ways were baristas. And so I would encourage baristas to really study their skills as sensory analysts because there's nothing better than a barista to fine tune a coffee and bring out the absolute best in it. I'll take the same coffee, go home. I can't do it. And yet I'll hand it off to a professional barista and I'll be like, how did you do that? What did you do? And that level of understanding is a really marketable skill. It's sensory analysis, it's quality control, it's quality assurance. So I would really encourage baristas, if you love tasting coffee and love, playing with the coffee to bring out the best in it, to study, to enter the world of sensory analysis, because chances are that's where, I know a lot of baristas are really proficient and excel. And then to also learn as much science as you can, because I think our industry needs to learn more science and needs to study more science and the impact of, temperature, thermodynamics. I was taking a University of Michigan online course on thermodynamics, very really tough course, but some of the things I learned about were the breaking down and reworking of the different elements in and the different compounds in coffee. I think baristas would be really good at that.
It's just funny that you mentioned these things like these sensory analysis jobs and science, but for so many baristas, like the trajectory is kind of almost the same. Like you work at a cafe, you manage it. Maybe you go on to a better cafe and it just seems like there's like a misalignment of skills. And I wonder why that happens.
Well, I think they have to stay in coffee and I hate there to be a brain drain in coffee, but if they're looking to go to the next level and use their skills, I mean, we have all sorts of tasting in the world of food science. And they could do it. When I was in Chicago working for the diversity consultant, one of the jobs she sent me out on was at a mustard company called Plockman's Mustard. And it was my first introduction to sensory analysis. I was there because they were doing statistical process control. And I was doing a basic math program for them. But I watched as they would do their mustard tasting. They would taste the batches of mustard. And the secretary at the time, she would go in and she would slip in, she would buy other brands of mustard and stick it into, their tasting and mix it in to see if they could tell the difference. And they were always able to pick it out. And I was shocked by that. I hadn't even thought those thoughts before, but there we are. So there's a whole world of sensory out there. And Lord knows a lot of roasters could really use some, quality assurance, quality control, or, replacement coffees. And the work, if a barista becomes more sensory focused, there's a lot they can do outside of our industry, but there's a lot they can do to help our industry move forward. And one of the things I really feel like we don't spend enough time doing is working with our customers. What do they like? I would encourage baristas who may not be sensory focused, but may be interested in marketing or talking to people or working with people to start focus groups at their coffee shop. What do you like? What do you like about this coffee? What could we do better? And, you know, have learn enough about sensory analysis to develop their own consumer panels for their coffee shop and study that and give feedback to the roaster, because ultimately that, you know, helps the entire chain of coffee. So there's that whole side of things too, that I think baristas could do within their own companies.
I think there's a part of the coffee industry that's like kind of has to assume leadership, if that makes sense. Like there are people who are going to have to be cafe managers, who are going to have to be lead baristas. And I wonder, like, how do we speak to those people to help them be the best at their jobs? Because, like, as you mentioned earlier, like, just because a barista is great at their job doesn't mean that they're necessarily, that their skills aren't necessarily aligned to be a manager. But a lot of people do have to step into those roles regardless, be it there's, you know, better wages or whatever. So, like, how do we help that group of baristas be better at their jobs? Like, what should managers be thinking about? What should people in leadership be thinking about?
They need to focus on what is their purpose for existing. I mean, in their company existing, like not human existence, but like, what is it you're trying to achieve with your company? What's your vision? Because a company is a group of people who come together and together are trying to provide, I mean, think about a cafe. Like, it's not just, I like coffee, I'm going to serve it. But people have visions and dreams for why they start a coffee shop. And, you know, then they onboard other people in the hopes that these other people, their employees, are going to help them, you know, work toward their dream. So those employees are giving their life energy to you, the leader, saying, I believe in you. I believe in this vision. And I know this is theoretical because a lot of people come to a job and are like, how much are you paying me an hour? I just want to earn my money and get out of here. But the best employees are people who say, I love this company. I love the way this cafe looks or feels, and I want to be part of it. And so they're actually, you know, they see what you're trying to achieve. So those are the people we want to hire. And then a leader has a responsibility not only to sort of keep them inspired, but to help take their life essence that they are providing by showing up every day, and you're paying them for their life essence, but honoring it and saying, you know, what else can you bring? What can we do together? To where can we take this project of ours that we call our cafe, this organization of ours, this group of people? And that's where the fun is. It's in the people. It's in the people within the coffee shop. It's in the people that we're serving, our customers. And that will generate more excitement. So the leader's job, how do you become a better leader, is by getting to know your people, getting to know what talents they have and what skills they have and what their dreams are and how their dreams fit into the dream of the cafe. And yeah, I don't know how to learn that, but I do know there's a whole lot of YouTube videos on leadership. And there's a lot of LinkedIn. And I mean, you just type in leadership and somebody's got some advice on how to be a better leader or how to lead your people.
Well, I think even just like the idea on a macro scale that your job is to make people proud to work there is huge, because I think that that's like not a thought that most leaders have.
Yeah, well, that's a shame, because these people, I mean, we all have, this is our time on earth. I'm choosing to spend it this afternoon with you, Ashley, because I value so much your podcast, what you're trying to do for the industry, that I want to be part of that. Like when you asked me to do this, you're like, you're my leader right now. And you, in turn, are honoring my life energy. We do this all the time within our cafe. And I think when we're frustrated with our employees, it's good sometimes to take a step back and say, where's that person in their life? And I'm not saying allow people's personal lives to, you know, negatively impact the business, but we all have our things. And, you know, where are we at? Where's this person? This is a human being who is alive today and is choosing to spend their time with you because you're paying them money. You're giving them dollars for their minutes, but their minutes have meaning. So what can you do to honor that and respect that? And I think once people know that their life is respected and honored, they're much more willing to contribute to what it is your organization is trying to achieve. I don't know.
No, I think you're totally right. I got into this argument with a friend of mine a couple of weeks ago about an employee that he has, and he's like, oh, well, he's just lazy or this and that. And I'm like, I felt bad. I pushed him a little hard on this, but I told him, I was like, no, that's your fault. Like, there's some reason why he's acting this way. Like, it's because you're not fulfilling like some sort of need that person has. And to assume that they're just lazy is kind of irresponsible.
Mm. It goes back to the human performance technology model. What is the cause of, why is there this gap in energy? You know, what's causing it? And remember, it could be environmental, which is my job as the manager or the cafe owner, or it could be what they call in HPT, a lack of repertory of behavior, which is, it's in the person. Does that person, why is this person lacking motivation? You want to eliminate anything environmental, anything that I have control over. And then you see what's left over is in the person, right? So a lot of it is, I mean, maybe the person has bad habits, bad behaviors, or, you know, poor behaviors. Maybe they're not feeling well. Maybe something's going on in their family life. Now, that's an adult. The employee is an adult. So it's up to all of us as adults to say, I got to bring it. This is my job. But some people haven't had the encouragement, or sometimes we're working with younger people who've never been in this situation of a job where they feel, you know, their personal life is overwhelming. They don't know how to bring it. They don't know how to compartmentalize or separate their home life from, or their personal life from, the fact that this job is, you know, if I lose this job, I'm going to have even more problems. And so sometimes a leader has to be, you know, take on a parenting role, but that's where the organization has to decide what to invest in the motivation. Like, how much are we going to do that? Or do we need to put consequences and rules in place that, you know, set the expectation, look, this is the level of energy and care and skill we need for performing these tasks, which have not been performed well. And, you know, we will give you X number of chances and provide you with X, Y, and Z. But otherwise, we have to move on because we can't have you affecting where we're going with this company. You know, so motivation is always the grayest area in the human performance scheme of things. If it's environmental, it's very clearly in the realm of the business owner or the manager or the supervisor. And I mean things like work tools, work environment, work design, et cetera. Sometimes it's in the like physical environment of the city, you know, or the state or the country, you know, but if it's within your control, you know, you do that, but the person has There once was a study done by Geary Rumler and Alan Brock, and I'm still trying to find the exact name, but they wrote a great book called something like The White Space in the Organization Chart. And anyway, there was this model that showed that about 85% of performance problems at work are related to the workplace, and 15% are actually within the worker. And that motivation and those habits and knowledge and skills, you know, all of that is within the worker. That's in that 15%. I don't know. That was a study done in the 90s, though. I'm interested if it's changed at all.
The last time we talked, you mentioned this like school of thought or this, I can't remember. Like, I'm looking through these old emails because you mentioned it, and I'm like, but you're here, so I might as well just ask you.
The Highlander folk schools.
Yes. Can you talk a little bit about those? Because that actually, like, when I researched the Highlander folk schools, like, it actually really impacted the way that I thought about leadership and empowering people.
Well, the Highlander folk schools were started in the 1930s. He was actually a workers' rights advocate, starting trade unions. You know, trade unions were the big thing in the 1930s. And people had to learn how to organize themselves. And this started, and it was in the coal mining areas of, I don't know if they were, I can't remember that. I think the Highlander folk schools are in Tennessee.
I think they are.
Yeah. And so Miles Horton, he had grown up, his parents were educators. And he started this folk schools where, I mean, they were just people coming together, communities, to learn about how to organize themselves. And it was interesting because at the same time, well, actually, a couple decades later, Paulo Freire in Brazil was doing the same thing with literacy in rural areas there. Anyway, people come together to solve their problems. And the Highlander folk schools, so that a lot of trade union organizing, they helped people learn about that in the 30s and 40s and 50s. But in the 50s, a young man named Martin Luther King came to Miles and said, you know, help us learn how to organize. And the civil rights movement started at Highlander. And that seems very grand, and those are huge issues that are real societal issues that Highlander was grappling with. But that spirit is how I like to think about developing coffee education programs, because we are still a young industry. I mean, there's still so much to discover and learn about coffee and solve problems together and grow together. So how the Highlander folk schools, I feel, relate to coffee is in the community learning aspect. Actually, with Ally this year, one of the ways I'm looking at doing supporting our clients, because Ally is named Ally because we are your ally for your business. So one of the ways I want to that I'm looking at supporting clients is with what we call communities of practice, which is an adult learning. We all know what these are. They're get-togethers. Whenever you have your barista events, throwdowns, people are learning from each other, learning from the competition. They're practicing beforehand, and then they get together and they talk about issues together. And they're kind of communities of practice. But we just did a community of practice with cafe leaders, where we worked around coffee. We did brewing and looking at water. We did some sensory analysis and tasting. But the best thing was for 2 days, baristas who were leader baristas in their companies and cafe owners, cafe managers were together. There were 18 people together, and they just talked to each other, and you know, they had universal issues that they worked on together. and they left feeling like they had found some solutions to some of their workplace concerns that they had. And so that was our cafe leader community of practice. But in March, we're doing a roaster community of practice that has been going for 13 years. It's called the Southeastern Roasters Consortium. And then I want to do a community of practice for cold brew. And I also want to do a community of practice for wholesale roaster trainers, which I think is a group of industry professionals who have a lot of similar problems and concerns and sticking points. So a roaster wholesale trainer, roasters have their beans that and their roasts that they've completed, and then cafe owners or managers or whatever buy the coffee. There's certain ways to bring out the best in the coffee, and the roaster wholesale trainers, you know, go with the coffee and talk to the cafe managers, and you know, they do education in cafes. So that's a community that has unique issues in terms of teaching other people. So there's learning, you know, teacher training or educator training or educator learning, whatever. But there's also the fact that you work for a different company going into one company, like somebody is going into your house and telling you how to brew your coffee. How do you do that? Like, what are some of the problems that come up doing that? How do you deal with different equipment, employee turnover, you know, follow through on training programs? So that's going to be a community of practice. So we've got our communities of practice, and this is something that I get from the Highlander Folk Schools, because I really feel like that sort of learning meets the needs of business and meets the needs of the industry. And that's really why Miles Horton, he wrote a book called We Make the Road by Walking. And I feel like that's the way that we approach specialty coffee still a lot.
Ildi, it's been incredible to talk to you again. every time I think about like where my career is going and the things that I'm good at and the things that I value, I think about what you would say. Like I have like my Ildi voice in my head.
Oh, goodness me. Well, I hope it tells you all sorts of positive things, because every single one of us is like, I mean, think about this. This is your time here, y'all. Make the best use of it. Think the thoughts that are going to propel you forward. Every time I was talking to one of my kids the other day and telling her, you can't think two thoughts at the same time. So if you find yourself thinking thoughts that are not helpful or that are negative or, you know, are not moving you forward, you've got to find a way to change those thoughts and move yourself forward. So thank you.
I just wrote down, this is your time here, y'all.
Well, I appreciate you so much, Ashley. I appreciate every barista out there who makes coffee and slogs away at it and really focuses on what they're doing. You're noticed. You're valued. Every coffee professional is valued, as long as you're caring for the people and the product. Thanks so much, Ashley.
Well, thanks again for taking the time to talk to us. I really appreciate it. And I know that our listeners are going to get so much from listening to you share your insights.
Thank you. And I hope everybody comes to visit me in South Carolina. Just visit us at Ally.
I was going to say, if people want to reach you, what should they do? But apparently it's to visit.
Yeah, show up. Ildi@allycoffee.com. ILDI at allycoffee.com.
Well, thanks again so much for joining us, and thanks to everybody out there listening.
Bye.
Boss Barista is made by me, Ashley Rodriguez, in collaboration with Good Beer Hunting, which is an industry-leading design studio, editorial platform, and podcast examining all the ways we look at the things that we eat and drink. You can check out more at goodbeerhunting.com. Seriously, their stories are incredible. My favorite series right now is the Humanity and Hospitality series that they've been running for the past couple of months, examining different ways that we look at people in the service industry. Special thanks to Jesse Raub and Jordan Stalling. Also, special thanks to our music contributors, the band Lost in the Sun. You've made this podcast sound incredible. I'm just looking for a better day.